Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. We continue to monitor the labor scene. It's day four of an indefinite strike by hotel workers against Hilton Hawaiian Village Waikiki Beach Resort. We hear from visitors today. And negotiators for nurses and Kapi'olani Medical Center for Women and Children resumed talks yesterday with help from, I'm told, two federal mediators. But no deal yet. They went back to the table at 10 a.m. All this week, we have been talking about birds and frogs and crickets and now pigs. Pua'a gets some time as well. What researchers are keeping an eye on. Plus, a new production celebrating Hawaiian music, old and new, and the connection between ancestors and present day opens on stage at the University of Hawaii. It's Aloha Friday, September 27th, the final day of our fall membership campaign. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's Aloha Festivals Week, and it winds up with a floral parade through Waikiki tomorrow to mark the 76th anniversary. Then on Monday, the state kicks off its tourism conference. And playing out behind all the buzz around our state's economic engine is a labor dispute with hotel workers. Talks broke off between Hilton and Unite Here Local 5 on the 12th, and on Tuesday, the 24th, union members walked off the job at the Hilton Hawaiian Village Waikiki Beach Resort. The union says workers from Sheraton and the Royal Hawaiian Hotel marched and joined fellow members on the picket line yesterday afternoon in a show of support. Workers paraded around the 21-acre property amidst a crowd of tourists who flocked to watch the sunset on the beach. You know, we caught up with a hotel guest who is here for a convention for the American Society for Horticultural Science, which started on Monday and ends today. Miro Stuke is with the University of Washington. He says he wasn't aware of the labor dispute until after he checked in. He says the picketing disrupted the conference and made for less than a pleasant stay.
I didn't have any idea until the walkout happened Tuesday morning.
And what's it been like for you at the hotel?
Well, for the conference center, we've run into a few like technical issues. We've had to sort of restructure the events that we've had planned as like social or informal events. That sort of like networking, socializing really hasn't been part of it because so many things are closed down and a lot of folks just don't want to stick around and socialize outside and that sort of thing. And then, yeah, even in some of our conference rooms, giving talks or trying to listen to these talks that we're all here for to learn about other folks' science and research, and we can hear the picket line in there. There was one day we've run into sort of like miscellaneous technical issues, and there was one day the attendees to this one session, and I was in the session and spoke at the session, but we all got locked in the room and we couldn't figure out how to unlock the door. And it's just been sort of like the support you would expect at a conference like this just hasn't been there. And we were informed on day one that there was sort of a contingency plan in place and, you know, that it really wouldn't affect very much. And that was really not the case. It's been kind of a mess.
And then what about just your hotel room and the guest services? What's that been like?
Yeah, the hotel rooms and guest services, there's been almost no sort of service, you know, things like checking in and checking out. We can't even talk to a person, and the lines are just ridiculous. Housekeeping has been totally shut down as well, and so I haven't had soap. I had to go out and buy soap because there was none in the room just to use the shower there, and then, like, we've had to sort of go on scavenger hunt to find towels if we need them and that sort of thing. And sometimes we can find them and sometimes we can't. And because this is like a, you know, it's a beach resort, there's just sand everywhere. Like, there's been no sort of cleaning in the common areas and stuff is really sort of turning into a mess and getting really, you know, kind of filthy at this point with the number of guests that have been through those common areas and the elevators and that sort of thing. It's quite a different experience than you would expect coming to a resort like the Hilton Hawaiian Village.
And Stuke was to check out of the Hilton today. The experience varied according to guests that we talked to. One woman said things had been fine for her stay. And another who just checked into the hotel said she'd have to wait and see from day to day. Christopher Cave, who lives on the mainland and travels through Hawaii almost on a monthly basis, says he usually stays at Hilton properties but opted for another hotel this trip.
Well, I was coming to see the sunset, and it looks like we might see a good one tonight. But yes, the Strikers have been present for the last few days that I've been here, and they obviously have a cause that they feel passionate about. If you spend any length of time here at the Hilton Hawaiian Village, you'll see that at some point in the day. So.
And you've stayed here at this hotel before?
I have. I've stayed right here at the Rainbow Tower that we're standing in front of. That was novelty for me because Elvis Presley stayed there, so I got to do that one time.
And then you say that sometimes you just stop off and say hi to the hotel workers?
Absolutely. You recognize people that that recognize me from coming every month, yes.
I was just wondering how the hotel guests are doing with so many people, you know, walking the picket line here.
Well, I've noticed that there are quite a few people here right now from Australia, which is a place that's near and dear to my heart. I've gotten to spend some time there over the years, but people seem to be friendly. It's like someone told me one time I misplaced my phone early on in a trip, and he said, "Hey, man, you're in Hawaii." So I think people just have that mentality, and they can overlook some of the maybe the shortcomings that would be wouldn't be present during a normal visit.
You're a world traveler here. I don't know. What do you think when you see a labor dispute like this?
I think it's kind of a sign of the times. I mean, people are, you know, as we were just talking, I don't feel like a lot of people feel like they're getting the value that they once did in the United States, and people feel like they're overworked and they're underappreciated. And this is a real problem, I think, throughout the country right now. It's not just limited to the hospitality industry. So the management and some of these entities, they're going to have to come to the bargaining table because you're going to see a lot more of this.
Yeah, I mean, this is just one hotel chain out of several that have been put on notice and are still trying to hammer out a new working contract.
Yeah, absolutely, and yeah, it's a lovely place, though. It's yeah, I can kind of compartmentalize and just remind myself I'm in Hawaii. But again, I haven't spoken to any of the strikers per se, but they are they're large in number, and they are quite vocal.
And that was Christopher Cave, a frequent visitor to the islands. We also spotted a bride on the beach. I went up to them and was told that the couple traveled all the way from South Korea with family, celebrating their anniversary, and they had just renewed their vows. They were to check out today and said the strike put a damper on their short visit. They lamented it was very inconvenient, but they tried to make the best of it. They opted to celebrate with a dinner on their last night off property. Efforts to get a statement from the hotel have not been successful. Meanwhile, the Hawaii Nurses Association returned to the bargaining table at 10 o'clock this morning. They met with the federal mediator yesterday till 7 p.m. Hotel workers say they may join the nurses in a protest line next week.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health, also known as HIOSH, recognizing September as Suicide Prevention Month. Learn more about risk factors, warning signs, and how to help at afsp.org. Support for HPR comes from Maui Ocean Center in Ma'alaya, committed to community, culture, and conservation, offering opportunities to experience Hawaii's marine ecosystem. Learn more at maui.oceancenter.com.
Consider this. There are an estimated 60,000 feral pigs running loose throughout the state. Scary thought, huh? And if that weren't bad enough, a new study finds that many of them are carrying a nasty disease. Swine brucellosis can jump over to livestock and humans. In Hawaii, there are several cases of it each year. Michael Norris runs the Pathogen Analysis and Translational Health Lab at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. He spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about his new research, which reveals troubling rates of brucellosis in Hawaii's feral swine.
Brucellosis is the disease caused by these organisms in the genus Brucella. It is actually several different types of bacteria. So there is a species adapted to pigs. There's a species adapted to cattle. There's a species adapted to goats. But the one that is the focus of this paper is Brucella suis, and that is found in swine, and that is mainly feral swine. And I point out that it is mainly found in them because we have spillover events that happen often between these animals and humans. The spillover events that we talk about are the handling of infected animal products, infected live animals, and this disease is kind of defined by a spectrum of symptoms that can cause things like chronic arthritis, night sweats. It is more of a debilitating infection than something that you will get very sick from immediately. And that makes it difficult to diagnose.
And so what you are looking at in this most recent study is Brucella suis, and how prevalent is it actually in Hawaii, in the Hawaiian Islands? And you go in with this presumption that maybe it will be similar to rates on the U.S. mainland. And in reality, what you find is that it is at least double those rates.
Right. So, you know, the rates on the mainland are roughly 6% in the feral swine population. And after analysis from our data from the last 15 years, we found that number to be on the order of 22%. And that's a little concerning. You know, we living in Hawaii, we see feral swine on the side of the road running around. And to think that maybe one in four of those are positive for this disease is quite shocking.
I love reading the method sections of papers. I think it really like puts yourself in the researcher's shoes. I don't know. I love the scientific writing of like, basically we shot 3,000 pigs in the head, but of course you presented it in a much more like sciencey sounding way. So how did that all happen?
Right. So that is an acceptable veterinary method of dispatching a feral animal. You know, I have to say this work was conducted over those 15 years by dedicated USDA APHIS employees as part of the National Feral Swine Damage Management Program. And so we utilized their information from the past 15 years, kind of plotted that out amongst all the watersheds in the state where those samples came from. And that involved taking blood samples, testing them for responsiveness to this brucellosis test.
What I really liked about this study is that you narrowed it down per watershed, and then you were able to zoom in and find basically hotspots on each of the islands.
Yeah. So originally we saw some data from the Department of Agriculture or the animal industry that said it was high in these islands and that was it, right? And so when you looked at it from an island by island perspective, it looked like, wow, or county by county, for example, right? And Maui County is several islands, right?
Yeah.
And when we looked at the data with a finer focus, we saw that Molokai was actually free from this pathogen from our sampling sizes. And actually, there were none taken from Lanai. It's very important in a place like Hawaii, where each island is its distinct ecosystem. And then, as you mentioned, on the island, in each watershed, we kind of have our own little isolated ecosystems, right? During the process of getting this paper reviewed, there was some argument about, well, why don't you use zip codes or this sort of thing? I said, well, in Hawaii, the zip code is irrelevant from an ecological perspective. At least that's my opinion. And so taking it down to the watershed seemed like a very relevant spatial unit.
Was there anything in the ecology of it or like any history that when you look at some of these hotspots on the different islands really leads you to think, oh, that actually matches up, that these areas on the north shore of Oahu, for instance, routinely have some of the higher rates of Brucella?
We kind of thought that maybe it would be connected to these kind of larger ag lands. And when we looked at the hotspots, we did this correlation analysis. It did sort of correlate with some of those agricultural lands on Oahu, especially because it was the most heavily sampled island. And the North Shore has a lot of these agricultural lands. So on Oahu, the ag lands were correlated with the high seroprevalence of the disease. On the Big Island, that was also true. What was really interesting was Maui. The Maui samples, there weren't too many of them, but the ones that were taken were overwhelmingly high. So the seropositivity rate for Waiakoa watershed, which is on the slopes of Haleakala, agriculturally very important land there, that was around 90% positivity.
Wow.
Right. And so that was very eye-opening, and that was in 2019. But what's important there is that last year, 2023, there was a domesticated swine operation. So people were growing, raising swine for sale. And it turned out to be a brucellosis outbreak in that operation. It's not well understood how that occurred, but because we had a very high spike in the wild feral swine brucellosis positivity rate in the same area several years before, you know, we kind of speculate that this was probably a spillover event that affected the agricultural sector.
Yeah. The question then becomes, like, how do you make it proactive rather than reactive?
So that's always an important part of this is how do we get it out to the agencies and the public health policymakers that make the decisions? I think this is a great opportunity to do that, talking about it, getting the story out there. But also, we are looking for more support to continue this study. So it needs to be continued, ongoing, so that we know, is this spike, is this sort of thing happening still, right? And if we can do that fast and we can do that focused in each of these areas that's a problem, then we can really have an idea of, you know, working with the state veterinarians on vaccinating. So one thing we haven't talked about is vaccination in agricultural operations. The vaccine can work in some of these high-risk environments, but again, a lot of times it is reactionary.
This isn't just a scientific question in a vacuum. You're not doing this research for total fun. Like, there's a line in the paper, the recent domestic swine outbreaks indicate, quote, a pernicious threat to agriculture in the state. So, like, why does having a good handle on Brucella and brucellosis matter right now?
It matters everywhere, I think. But in Hawaii, we are always trying to increase the in-state production of food. Food security is really important. And the more we can produce here on the islands, the less we have to rely on importation of food from the mainland. It's also a very important economic source for people that own the farms and the ranches. If these operations have to shut down or cull herds and all that, it's a very big economic hardship. And by understanding how much brucellosis is there, we know it's pernicious because it's the rate of it is 3 times higher than that of the mainland. And so by ignoring it, it will not go away.
Yeah. And then finally, brucellosis in marine mammals. No, not the monk seals.
So we have no indication it's in the monk seals.
Okay, good.
Yet. But we should definitely be cautious of that. Working with some folks at the UH Health and Stranding Lab, and there is definite evidence of this pathogen affecting the marine mammals too, dolphins, whales. And we've been able to actually genome sequence the first brucellosis in marine mammals here. So we know it's not, at least the one that we have sequenced, is not the same one as the one in the swine. But this, of course, requires more work. Until we know more, right, we cannot say that the brucellosis is not transmitting from the land to the sea here.
Anything else that you want to add? Anything you feel like listeners especially could know or knowledge they could benefit from having?
The highest risk are the people that handle the raw meat. So take care handling that meat. Cook it thoroughly. The general public probably doesn't need to worry about this so much, but we definitely need to keep an eye on it.
That was University of Hawaii microbiologist Michael Norris. His recent paper was published in the journal Frontiers in Public Health. He says he'll be looking further into brucellosis in marine mammals, as well as studying it in axis deer, wild goats, and wild cattle in Hawaii.
Support for HPR comes from the State Office of Elections, reminding residents that Hawaii is a vote-by-mail state. Registered voters should be sure their mailing address is up to date for the general election. More at elections.hawaii.gov. Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health, also known as HIOSH, committed to the people of Hawaii, working to help keep workplaces safe and protect employees' rights. More by searching HIOSH.
A new play celebrating Hawaiian music from the 1930s and its influence on Hawaiian music in current day premieres at the University of Hawaii's Kennedy Theater tonight. It's titled Puana and was co-written by Professor Tammy Ha'ili'opua-Baker with contributions from a creative team that includes celebrated Kumuhula Keawe Lopez and award-winning musician Zachary Alakailam. It's a story told predominantly in the Hawaiian language and features several big numbers. The Conversation's Russell Subiono had the chance to attend a rehearsal early this week and sat down with Ha'ili'opua-Baker to talk about the production.
The task thus placed before me is to express from the heart of my being an authentic rendition of the legacy of my ancestors.
This story is really about the unpacking and the understanding of how our ancestors' journeys might inform our journeys today and how they sometimes communicate to us through song and the accepting and the understanding that they do visit us.
When I had a chance to watch it, I felt like there was a lot of love in there for modern day Hawaiian music, but especially for Hawaiian music from the early 1900s, the time when Hawaiian music became part of American pop culture. Can you talk about the role music and its performance plays in your production?
I want to express my gratitude and real joy to be able to collaborate with individuals that are amazing composers and music arrangers. And we know how important music is in our legacy and in the understanding of who we are and how our ancestors communicated with one another, and the importance of poetic expression when we tell a story. And this goes back to, you know, something that Mary Kovena Pukui once said, that no legend was complete without a song, right? No story was complete without a song. And so having that at the forefront as we collaborated and collectively developed this story, and then Keawe's mana'o to bring in Zachary Alaka'ilam to come in and compose with him and arrange with him and be our lead as a musical director. It's such a blessing to be able to work in this kind of space collectively and develop new songs that are reminiscent of the past. You know, when you hear the songs, it really sounds like, oh, this is 1930, 1940, but they're actually new compositions.
Wow.
That Zach and Keawe were able to accomplish. Wow. By creating and arranging, composing to emulate compositions of that time. And the reason for creating new songs was also to be able to align with the narrative, the story that we were telling. And there's this theme song, you could say. We have two theme songs, I think. One of which is A Puana, which encapsulates the whole concept of the play, right? A Puana, it will blossom, it will be said, it will come again. So this idea that there's a legacy, that things are being passed down from one generation to the other. And then the other one is No Ku'ukama Ku'ulei. So these songs, when you hear them, you think that they're from the past, but they're actually new compositions.
You know, when you go to a theater, sometimes you get dialogue. Sometimes you go to watch a group perform. You get both in this. You get a story through dialogue between characters, and you get some really, really great musical performances. What gave you the idea to write the play in this way?
The concept for this particular story of Puana really came from some family research that we were doing and unfolding of understanding of some ancestors that we had that went abroad, shared music, and then came home and they were featured on TV or they had experiences in producing music, but then their names faded away. And so that idea of sharing family stories that may only have been passed down in a family, but these individuals may not be household names. They might not be the Alfred Apakas or the Bill Kaivas or the Bill Ali'iloa Lincolns. But so many of our families, when we start having these conversations, have stories of family members who went abroad and did these things. The idea of having the story being told through the grandfather's words is something that I felt really strongly about, and in conversation with my co-playwright, who is also my son, Kaipula Makani Olono, we were able to really capture some of the shifts and thoughts that was happening around the time of statehood and around the time of the Renaissance. And Kaipu and I really started looking at pieces that were written by individuals like John Dominus Holt, and looking at things that were in the newspapers. And then also my husband, Kaliko Baker, had some family memoirs that was written by his great-great-grandmother. And so understanding what was there and for what we had to infer, and then trying to weave these things together, right? We were inspired by various stories of musicians and of our ancestors, and weaving that together so that we have different perspectives brought forward and words from the past that are meeting words from today, and then songs from the past meeting songs from today, and putting that into a lay and weaving a lay that would capture moments in time and shifts in Mana'o and present that for the audience to kind of sit in those experiences and be able to reflect and understand the value of Mo'olelo, the value of our narratives, the value of our mele, and hopefully inspire people to maybe do some family research as well.
The majority of the dialogue is in Olelo Hawaii. What was behind your decision to have the main characters speak to each other in Hawaiian, even in those everyday situations?
The whole concept behind that is that Olelo Hawaii is alive. Mm-hmm. Olelo Hawaii is alive and well. And we do have communities of speakers. All of them are graduates from Hawaiian immersion programs, two of which went on to Kamehameha schools. But all of them went through Hawaiian immersion. Two of them come from Olelo Hawaii households. And so it is natural for them to be speaking Olelo Hawaii together. And that was the reason for writing this in Olelo Hawaii. Not that we were precast, but what I wanted to do is put forward a world in which Olelo Hawaii is alive and well. And on top of that, Hanakeaka, this form of theater, Hawaiian language, Hawaiian medium theater, which we have cultivated and created a program for here at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. This form is really a tool for the empowerment of Kanaka Maoli consciousness. When we are telling our stories in our language, performing our no'eo, right? Any kind of performing or visual arts, and also honoring our mo'oku auhau, our genealogies, we are empowering our identity and who we are. So this movement is really an empowerment for our lahui, to empower our consciousness and our identity and our language, to create a stronger foundation for the generations to come.
And thank you for that, because I'm not fluent in Olelo Hawaii, but I can pick out words and I kind of get the gist of it. Did you do anything special with the blocking or how you direct the actors to be able to bring the non-Hawaiian speaking members of the audience into the story?
I believe that we are such expressive people, right? We don't just talk with our hands. Mm-hmm. We talk with our facial expressions. We talk with our body language. And I do believe that audience members, no matter if they have a little exposure, no exposure, deep exposure, that they will be able to follow the story along. One of the things that we're finalizing right now is the scene chart that we're putting into our play guide for those non-speakers or for people who want a little bit more information about what's going on in the scenes. So I do feel that the scene chart alongside with the talented cast who's able to communicate all the emotions that they are experiencing is enough, I guess you could say, for people to pick up on. And it's one of those things where I think you can watch it more than once and you can get a little more each time. Even if you're a language speaker, if you watch it more than once, there's another layer that you're able to uncover in the telling of the story. Yeah.
We've had a good discussion on honoring our kupuna and the music that binds a lot of us, our ancestors, and us today. What would you like audiences to take away when they come and see Puana?
I really hope that people are able to understand the deep connections that we have with our ancestors, with their poetry, and that poetry being connected to the aina and what John Dominus Holt wrote about, the Hawaiian aesthetic. The aina is who we are. And the love for that and the gratitude for that is expressed in song. It's expressed in different types of poetry, whether it be chant or song. And as Kanaka, music is something that is innate in us. It is a velo. It's a trait of who we are. And this production really honors that. It honors the musicality and the beauty in that and how we're able to honor our aina and honor our ancestors at the same time when we sing a lyric, when we sing something and play instruments that is fashioned in the way that our ancestors played it. When we hear the steel guitar, we are immediately transported, taken to this place, taken to a time, taken to a genre, and taken even to particular musicians and bands that use that sound. Moments like that with the steel guitar and us seeing the kupuna on stage, we just, boom, we know, right? And we're in it. We're in it and we're able to go on that journey.
Kumu, Tammy, Ha'ili Opua, Baker, thank you so much for your time.
Mahalo, Andrei.
That was UH Theater Professor Tammy Ha'ili Opua Baker talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. The new stage production, Puana, premieres tonight at Kennedy Theater and will also run next weekend. We'll have a link to more information on the conversation page of our website later today. And that is it for our show today. I'm Catherine Cruz.